Just a word of warning for today's episode of Glam City. There will be some strong language.
Welcome to Glam City, listeners. I'm Tamsin Peach.
And I'm Anna Clark, and you are listening to Glam City. GLAM stands for Galleries, Libraries, Archives and Museums, that tricky little acronym that tells you the sort of what's on for history in our backyard in Sydney.
And today we are welcoming to the studio Mandy Sayer. Hello, Mandy.
Hi, Tamsin.
Hi. We've been very excited about your new book, Australian Gypsies, Their Secret History. So that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, we're sort of going back in time to discover a very hidden history in Australia's past, really, which surprises me. We're both historians. We feel like we know our stuff, but I didn't know anything about this.
Neither
story.
Did I. That's why it was such a great book to write.
These
amazing discoveries that and connections that I was able to make between Aboriginal people and Romany gypsies, for example. And so there are very few new stories in the world, but this is one of them.
Mandy is a street performer turned writer. She's both an award-winning novelist and non-fiction author, including the award-winning memoir Dreamtime Alice and The Poet's Wife. And her latest book out on the shelves, as we just said, is Australian Gypsies, Their Secret History. Mandy, to write the book, travelled all around Australia researching this hidden history, gathering stories, oral histories, archives from gypsy families, because, of course, many of them wouldn't be in public archives, I'm guessing.
No, they aren't, no.
And to tell this incredible story of Romany people's lives in Australia that have remained basically undocumented within Australia's official history. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
How did you come across this story?
In 2015, I was in Budapest because my husband was writing a screenplay for a Hungarian gangster.
As you do.
And we had a fair bit of free time. My husband was actually grifting the gangster. He writes very quickly, but told him he writes very slowly. So we spent a lot of time socialising and listening to music and jazz. And we went up to a concert in Eger, which is out in the country, 2 hours outside of Budapest, to a jazz concert. Afterwards, we went backstage and met the band and had a great time with them. They invited us out to dinner. And over dinner, I got on really well with the pianist, who was a very large, dark-skinned man with a fabulous sense of humour. And so much so that he invited me and my husband around for dinner once we got back to Budapest, and he was going to cook for us and play us music. His brother, the drummer, was also there. And then he turned to me and said, "I'm a gypsy." And I was astonished because my references about gypsies were always from children's books, really, and media created by people who were not gypsies. So I was only aware of the stereotypes from Enid Blyton and Wind in the Willows and Charles Dickens, you know, with the Pretty Little Caravan and the violins. The man before me, Joseph, did not correspond with my image of a gypsy at all. He was very dark-skinned, magnanimous, and extremely generous. So after we left Eger, we got on the train to go back to Budapest, and I saw a shanty town along the side of the road, the railway road, and this community was living in cardboard boxes underneath corrugated iron. The kids were barefoot, almost naked. They looked like they were starving. And I turned and said to my husband, "My God, what is that?" And he said, "That's a gypsy camp." And I couldn't believe that the people of my new best friend were being forced to live in such a way, and in contemporary times. It shocked me so much that when I returned to Australia, I began researching the true history of the Romany people, who were exiled from India between the 11th and 13th centuries. And so that was my first connection with a gypsy or a Romany gypsy. And he was such a good example, a great example, and a great icon of his people, that it was wonderful to meet him, and he was the one who really kicked off my deep interest in their culture.
So how did you get from Hungary to Australia? I mean, you came back and you were looking at the kind of history and origins.
Yes.
And what made you think, well, what's the story here?
Well, I started, you know, obviously reading a lot of books on Australian history, and there's no mention of Romany gypsies in any of there's only four books where they were mentioned very, very briefly in the context of a much larger subject. So I found out that James Squire, for example, who was on the First Fleet, Australia's first beer brewer, he was a Romany gypsy. And I thought,
How
did I find out? Well, through newspaper reports, through Trove, and also his mother was part of what was called the Canning Affair. And it proved he was a Romany gypsy because she was persecuted in court in England. And she was absolutely innocent of the crime that she was accused of and was eventually let off. But it was a huge controversy in England at the time. So I found out that. I began asking around my friends, do you know of any gypsies in Australia? And my husband said that there used to be a gypsy camp in La Perouse in the 1950s. Another friend said her aunt remembers them knocking on the door at Manly and offering to tell fortunes for a few pennies. And then a good friend of mine who lives down the road from the pub where I drink in Woolloomooloo brought up a newspaper clipping which stated that the Prince of the Gypsies, Costa Stereo, died in his house in 1943. Once I saw that newspaper report, I knew I had a story, that there was a big, big story here that no one had really unravelled. So that's when I hit Trove, which is search engine, and I found reports of gypsies dating right back to the Second Fleet in newspaper reports. So that sort of set me off as well. I knew that I didn't just want to write about the chronological history of Romany in Australia. I also realised that I didn't want it to be a museum piece. I wanted to also find out and represent the Romany experience in Australia today. Mm. So there are about 8 or 9 profiles of Romany families from all around Australia, from individuals to families.
It's a very, it is a very living history in the book, and the photos that you show are both historical but also very contemporary, and it gives you a real sense of this kind of culture from all over the world that is essentially gypsy culture. It's amazing. And I, why hasn't these history been told before now, do you think?
Well, it's not entirely the fault of Australian scholars and academics. They have lived in secret deliberately for, you know, since the First Fleet. One reason why is because they've been escaping persecution in Europe. In the 1500s and 1600s, it was illegal to be a gypsy. You could be murdered for being a gypsy. You could also be hung for selling any food to a gypsy. So that's why the stereotypes of the thefts and stealing came up. They had to steal a chicken or a watermelon or a pumpkin to feed their kids because they couldn't buy any. Also, during the World War II, 1.5 million Romany gypsies were exterminated. They were targeted. That was the second ethnic group that was targeted. So, and that wasn't that long ago, okay? It's only 60 years ago or 70 years ago. So when they come here, they just announce the country of origin, not their ethnic identity. So they'll just say they're Hungarian or they're German or they're Albanian or they're Macedonian. And they don't put their ethnic identity on census forms either. They're just still very scared. The other problem is that even today, they don't announce to an outsider that they're a gypsy because inevitably the stereotypes come up immediately. The first thing they'll do is say, oh, I think I've got a bit of gypsy blood in my family. And I've witnessed that so many times when I've been socialising with my gypsy friends with outsiders. And they don't realise how disrespectful that is. That's like saying, oh, I think I've got a little drop of Aboriginal blood in me. It's so condescending and patronising. The second thing that will happen is that the palm will immediately go out and they'll want their fortune told. And that's a bit disrespectful too. So it's a hassle dealing with outsiders because they don't really know the truth of the gypsy culture and history, and so they'd rather not deal with it. So the only reason I was able to enter that community is because I was aware of all this before I began a conversation with them. Yeah.
So it must have been quite important to get the consent of the community.
Oh, that was very important. Yeah, when I would contact them, the first thing I would say is, look, I know a lot of bullshit's been written about you people by people like me, and I want to correct that. The second thing is I offered them anonymity if they wished to have it. Eventually, none of them chose to do that. And the third thing I offered was whatever I wrote about them in a chapter, they would get to read and edit And even if what they said was on the record, if they wanted to take it off the record, that was certainly a choice that they would always have. So everybody got to be in charge of their own story, which was very important to me because it's so easy to misrepresent their culture.
So there's been many decades and even centuries of gypsies sort of withholding their stories and keeping them so that they're not exploited.
Yes.
And that the trust that they put in you to tell their story. So there's also a desire to get it out there a little bit.
I'd say so, yes. One man I've become very close to, he's the only surviving grandson of the Queen of the Gypsies, Mary Stereo. She and her relatives arrived in Adelaide in 1898 as refugees. They were very much persecuted by the Australian press for 50 years. The press just hounded them, wrote lies about them, said that they were, all kinds of things, practicing black magic, all kinds of rubbish was printed about them. So he said to me, look, you can write anything about us you like as long as it's not bullshit. You know, don't lie. Even if it's the truth and it's bad and it reflects badly on us, I don't care as long as it's not a lie.
Mm.
And I said, well, I wouldn't be sitting here if I wanted to make up stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So, they are very happy, I think. And some weren't aware of where their families had come from, and I was able to help them with that. Because it's an oral tradition, of course, some of the stories got lost along the way. And so it's also about connecting the different communities as well, because they are quite disparate and disconnected because they come from so many different places. So
that was one of the really striking things reading about this is how multicultural gypsy community is.
Yes, very much so, yeah.
You know, in your book, you're showing people from Greece and from Hungary and from the UK. It's an extraordinary.
Yeah, you've got Muslims, you've got born-again Christians and everything in between, yeah.
What drew you to the subject? You talk a little bit in the introduction about your own background as a daughter of a musician and your childhood sort of travelling a lot in the US and so on, and I guess part of that kind of show movement.
And also living day-to-day.
Yeah,
very much so. I thought that was probably why I had an affinity with the subject when I began. However, when I finished the book and I read through it maybe for the last time, I realised it wasn't that at all. I was actually, because I come from a very dysfunctional and fractured family, and both my parents had died by the time I went to Hungary. My mother had only died 3 weeks before I went to Hungary. So after reading it and looking at all the friendships that I'd developed around the country with the community, I realised I was actually looking for a sense of family and a sense of community that wasn't really in my own life. And it means a lot to me that they are so unswervingly loyal to one another. And even, for example, when I would ring somebody up, a stranger up, and they're talking to me as a stranger and I explain what I'm doing and they invite me down and they say, most of them would say, oh no, don't go stay in a hotel, you come and stay with us, we'll pick you up at the airport, all that. The generosity and the welcome was really moving to me. And another reason why I think I was attracted to the culture is being a freelance writer all my life, and before that being a street performer, I've always lived off my wits, as they have. And they never know when their next job is coming, and neither do I as a freelance writer. You know, my finances go up and down all the time. And, you know, at the age of 54, I start to wonder, oh, God, can I keep this up until I'm 70 or whatever? But through their example, I realise they can. They have it a lot tougher than I do, and they're all happy.
Do you think that desire to, bring you in and help you tell their stories shows that there's a sort of an opportunity it's the timing is right to make it more public now for a history that's been so kind of secretive and hidden for so long?
Well, they're the ones who have decided whether that's going to be made public or not. I probably approached about 50 people and I think only three declined. So that's a pretty good average in the sense that they're just tired of lies being told about them. I think that's more it than anything. And it's refreshing that they have an opportunity. They find it refreshing. They have an opportunity to tell the truth.
So potentially your book changes a lot for them in terms of how they're understood in the public. Does it change how we think of Australian history as a consequence?
Well, I'd have to ask you, I guess. You're the historians, not me. What do you think?
I don't know. Histories of hidden histories sometimes can add to the historical record. They tell us things that we didn't know. You know, there's 50% of the population are women. Like, let's add them back into the story. But when you do that, sometimes a big shift happens because it changes how we've thought about the past. Yes. You know, you have new actors contributing to the processes that we thought, you know, were governed by other people. And I haven't actually read your book yet, but I'm looking forward to seeing if we can do that with this.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, I hope that this can be a springboard for opportunities for the Romani to take over and tell their own stories, publish their own books. And feel free to contradict me.
But also joining a kind of a public conversation for a community which has essentially been kind of fringe dwellers. And a lot of the photos in your book really show that. They literally are fringe dwellers in Australian society and up until now, fringe dwellers in the Australian historical narrative.
Yes, that's right. Absolutely.
Yeah. And actually, speaking of fringe dwellers, like Aboriginal communities around Australia, there seem to be quite a lot of overlaps.
Absolutely. There still are a lot of overlaps. In fact, James Squire befriended the Indigenous leader Bennelong actually saved Governor Phillips' life in Manly. Bennelong had escaped from the camp here went back to Manly. And Governor Phillip chose a guy called Aaron Davis and James Squire to accompany him to Manly to encourage Bennelong to return to the camp. When they arrived, Governor Phillip was speared in the leg. Aaron Davis dropped his gun and pissed off and freaked out and ran away, while Squire went up to the Aboriginal people and negotiated with them, went back to Governor Phillip, negotiated with him, so much so that the Aboriginal people decided that they wouldn't be violent anymore. And Bennelong happily accompanied Governor Phillip and Squire back to the camp. So he had very good negotiating skills. Bennelong and Squire became such good friends that Bennelong moved on to the land that Squire had been granted. And eventually Squire buried Bennelong on his land up on a hill, Orange Grove, overlooking Parramatta River. So that's what the first connection. The second one was Henry Lavelle, who was also on the First Fleet. Married an Aboriginal woman, had a child, and then when he was able to travel back to England, took her and the child with him. They rejoined his gypsy group back in England. So we've got an Aboriginal woman and child travelling around with a gypsy group for many years. They had a second a daughter called Sappy, and when she was 16, she was pregnant. And because she was pregnant, she stole a silver spoon. And for that, she was incarcerated for a year and transported to Australia. So she had to go back to the homeland she'd never been before. And it was, you know, an experience exactly the same problems that her father had initially. And when she was finally released, she married another gypsy man and had children. Yep. So, yeah, and also the Aboriginal people helped the gypsies adapt to the Australian landscape and bush, taught them how to harvest honey, how to make toys out of wax, how to find water, all those things. They're also both nomadic. They don't hoard food. They have very tight kinship connections. They have a lot in common and a common ancestry in India.
Listeners, you're listening to Glam City on 2SER 107.3. To download this show, head to 2SER.com or your favourite podcast app. It's in iTunes as well, and look for Glam City. This podcast is made by the Australian Centre for Public History at UTS with support from 2SER. And don't forget to leave us a rating or a review on iTunes. It really helps other people find us.
In your book, you use these three strands that you describe. It's a historical strand, which sort of is a chronology of the history of gypsies in Australia. Some information, cultural information about their traditions, which to me was just, I mean, I didn't know anything about this at all. And also some beautiful profiles of gypsies, which shows that it's, you know, this is a living history and it's not some sort of time capsule that's locked in, you know, James Squire land
exactly.
The 1780s or whatever.
Yes.
What was the motivation for writing it this way and how did it inform the way you went about the research and telling the story?
Well, even before I began researching the book, I knew that I would have to have living subjects. I also realised that nobody really knows what gypsy customs, true gypsy customs and traditions are. So I knew that I would have to have those three strands. However, having said that, I stole the concept from my husband, Louis Naura, who had just published a book on King's Cross, a biography of King's Cross, and he was the one who developed the three-strand structure. So basically, I appropriated it from him, and it worked really well.
Thanks, Louis.
And people have come up to him and said, "You two, have you copyrighted that three-strand structure? Because it really works, and it works in contemporary times because people have such a short attention span."
Yeah,
I found with the historical sections they were much longer, and I often had to cut them in half just to keep the momentum going. And it rollicks along that way. And also you can dip into any part of it and still get something out of any short chapter.
How does that writing the contemporary life stories contrast with doing the research about the historical characters? Did you feel like there were lots of connections between them, or did you feel like you were writing quite different gypsy histories?
No. I was determined to find the descendants of the Stereo family, for example, because I knew that they were still here in great numbers. And I wanted to follow this, join the historical story that ends in 1982 with the personal ones, which I'm able to pick up at the end and find out why they were on the road for 80 years, why they ended up in jail so often, and the living conditions from their point of view. So I was able to track down four descendants of that family who were profiled. And that was really important to me to find that. And also I found the descendants of the Macedonian gypsies who arrived in the 1960s. That's a very strong community now in Perth. There's 14,000 Romani gypsies living in Western Australia now. That's probably the most cohesive community. I didn't really see that much difference between the two. Having a background in profile writing for journalism, I didn't find that too taxing. I was a little worried whether I could pull off the history. I've never written history before. I mean, I do have a doctorate in research and writing, but it's, literary theory. It wasn't history. So I was excited about that challenge. Mm-hmm. I was at a point in my life, too, where I felt like I wanted to do some serious study again. I missed being an academic, basically. And so I really enjoyed doing that. And you probably know, being historians yourself, the story is so big. So like a fiction writer, you do have to choose certain events and certain stories that will amplify it or be an example so it can amplify into a bigger story. It's because there was just such a wealth of information on the Stereo family itself. I could have written a whole book on them, which I wouldn't mind doing one day.
Well, there's some amazing pictures you've got in your book of the Stereo family, yeah. And this one in particular of Ruby Stereo,
yes,
Adams, laid in state in her caravan on her death.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if you could paint a word picture for our listeners of what's in that photograph.
Well, it's an elderly woman laying on her back on a bed in a caravan. It's a very ornate bedspread she's lying on. It looks like it's textured. She's got a shawl draped around her that's fringed. She's got a beautiful little cap on her head. Her arms are folded over her stomach. And she's got a big, long Romani dress on, a gypsy dress on that goes down past her ankles. This is another reason why it was important for me to link the history with the living families now, because when I met some of the family members, I'd show them these photos that they'd never seen before.
Wow.
And this one, for example, I showed Nick Morgan this. He said, "That's my mother." This is a famous photo taken by Max de Payne in the 1930s in the Domain. It's called Gypsies in the Domain. It's a beautiful photograph. He said, "That's my mother." So I sent him a copy of the photo framed because he'd never seen it before. There's another one of Mary Stereo in 1907 that the family had never seen before. That's Nick Morgan's grandmother.
And his parents, or those are her children?
They're her children, yes. And once I started showing them photos that I'd collected, like this one, which is Ruby and Mary Stereo at the funeral vigil held for Costa Stereo, they started bringing out their own photos and sharing them with me. And so they shared quite a few as well, which was incredibly generous and trustworthy.
Why was she known as the Queen of the Gypsies? What does that mean?
Every group or Vitsa or Nazia has a king and a queen. This is not really part of their culture. These are people nominated to be the head of the extended family. And these people negotiate with outsiders. They're the ones who make the decisions. And it's really the hierarchy.
Well, traditionally, would they have been in control or decision makers about where to leave or when to leave?
Yes.
And where they would be going?
Yes,
and
absolutely, yes. And as you see, it can go for either gender. You can be a queen or a king. But the older you get, the more authority you have in the community and in the family. In fact, the highest status you can achieve is old age, which is why suicide is virtually uncommon in the culture. Because, you know, you're actually cutting off your own potential to reach old age, and I love that. Also, the families, unlike us Westerners who, you know, stick our grandparents in nursing homes, in Romani families, the kids will actually have fights over who gets to inherit the grandparents to come and live with them. They will argue over it because it's a great honour to look after the elders.
You talk in the book about how Gough Whitlam,
yes,
changes a lot of immigration policy, is that,
yes,
right? What,
yes,
what changes in the 1970s?
Well, he demolished the last of the White Australian policy, and he opened up the doors in a way that they'd never been before. Anyone could migrate here from Europe as long as they decided to work for 2 years, and then they could leave or whatever, because we needed workers. So a lot of gypsies took advantage of this in the early 70s because you didn't even have to be highly skilled. And you didn't have to speak English. And so he actually changed the world for gypsies and created this kind of haven. So, and all of them chose to come here and, again, live in secret. They were just so grateful to have this opportunity. They all agree that Australia really is a haven. We've never had laws against gypsies in Australia specifically. We've never had the kinds of wars where gypsies have been scapegoats. The only problems we've really had is the ones that I suffer from, which is the reading of the stereotypes created by outsiders about them. But, you know, I'm hoping this book will change people's points of view and educate them a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, those stereotypes are imported as well in a way.
Yes.
Yeah. You're describing your colonial childhood books.
Actually, yes, that's right. Yeah. And we all have that. And even movies like Carmen and even, you know, that stupid show called My Big Fat Gypsy Wedding. It's still very patronising. You know, they're still portrayed as thieves and in and out of jail and extravagant and a little bit silly. Look, the gypsies here in Australia watch it and laugh because they know they're not like that at all. Most of the people on that show are travellers, which is a different ethnic group altogether. But because they do travel, you know, I have to say it's not in the gypsy blood to travel as well. A lot of people think that, oh, it's in the blood. It's not. It's just because laws were imposed upon them throughout all these countries, and so they had to keep on the move to escape the authorities. It started off as a necessity, but here in Australia now they travel for pleasure. Most are settled. There are I know of several Romani gypsies who are still on the road, but most of them are settled, but will have a caravan in the driveway so they can go on a holiday and be in nature.
And keeping alive cultural traditions,
yes,
rather than having been forced to keep moving.
Yes, that's right. And they still do meet in secret. Like every Christmas, there's about 100 gypsy families will meet in the caravan park and celebrate. But again, they don't advertise it. It's all word of mouth.
Yeah. There aren't gypsy Facebook groups that are open that everyone can kind of keep a...
No, there's nothing like that, but there are family groups, and so they and I have to say gypsies love the internet. It, you know, because before mobile phones, they had to keep in touch with one another by public phones, and that was hit and miss because they're all on the road. When the mobile phone came in, it changed their lives. So they could get work so much easier. They could keep in touch with one another. Facebook, they love Facebook because it's free. You know, they can keep in touch and post photos. It really has changed their lives. They can connect with other groups in Europe, and it's been a great, great service for them.
So where can people buy your book?
In a bookstore.
Every good bookstore?
Every
it's
good
published
bookstore.
By New South Press.
Yes, you can order it from New South Press or go in and buy a nice signed book. Some of them are signed in Sydney. Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really fantastic to hear about this hidden history, and I'm looking forward to reading the book. But before we go, we're going to glam slam you.
Yes.
This is the segment where we ask what's coming up in your diary. So what history stuff is on the horizon for Mandy Sale?
On the 5th of November, I'm doing a talk at Muse Restaurant and Wine Bar and Bookstore in Canberra, which should be fun because there'll be wine involved.
And books.
And on the 13th of December, I'm doing a talk at Woollahra Library as well. So that's probably my diary for the next couple of months.
Brilliant.
Talking you can history.
See Mandy in person. What about you, Anna Clark?
I am going to Sydney Open.
Me too.
Yeah, we're both going.
Both going.
To Sydney Open. On the 4th and 5th of November, Sydney Open is inviting everyone to come inside and see what's behind the facade of our heritage treasures that trace Sydney's beginnings. So on Saturday, the 4th of November, you can explore some of Sydney's most in-demand spaces and buildings, old and new, take tours with Sydney Living Museums experts. And then on Sunday, the 5th of November, you can make your own itinerary using their open access program. So I'm going to do both.
The history-tastic. I am very excited about going to the mortuary station.
Ooh,
which I've driven past 1,000 times near Central Station and never actually been through the gates of. So that's...
I might come with you to that. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Bit of a cemetery nut.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
To find out more.
I take photos of graves. Haven't you seen in the book?
To find out more, head to sydneylivingmuseums.com.au/sydneyopen. And that brings us to the end of our show.
Yeah, for another week. Thank you very much, Mandy.
Thank you.
Thank you, Anna. This has been Glam City. If you want to hear more from us, head to the 2SER website, which is, as you know, 2SER.com, and search for us on our favourite podcast app. And you can also find us on Twitter. Are you on Twitter?
No, I'm not.
Oh, we're very good. You've escaped the dominion of
the
Twitter.
The bandwagon of social media.
But I am there as Cap and Gown, and Anna is...
at Anna Hope Clark.
Anna Hope Clark. Thank you once again and see you next week.
Glam out.
Glam out.